Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello there and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? I hope you're well. And I really do hope that you and yours are well whenever it is that you're listening to this. I'm recording this on a Thursday evening, as I normally do, but it's just, I feel strange because I'm doing so in the wake of news that has come in from Barcelona, a terrorist attack. On the Ramblas, during which, at the moment, they're saying 13 people have been killed. Many more injured, some of them very seriously. And I'm a bit freaked out. I'll tell you why I'm a bit freaked out. A, because, well, I love Barcelona. I used to live there, as many of you know. It's a town that it's just my favorite place. And I was there only very recently. But B, my daughter lives in Barcelona. She lives there with her boyfriend. Her boyfriend works in a kiosk on the Ramblas. It was the kiosk into which, or outside which, the van drove, destroyed part of the kiosk, and obviously killed and injured so many of those people. Thankfully, he is all right. His workmates are all right. I think one of them, as far as I know, has some minor injuries, but obviously they're suffering from shock and trauma. But thankfully, nothing more serious than that. Not that it's not serious, but in the grand scheme of things, you know what I'm saying. But what really freaked me out was the fact that we were just over there in July, and the night before we were going home, we went down to the Ramblas, to that kiosk, to say goodbye to her boyfriend. And we were going to go meet her. She was going to work, and we were just going to pop in and say goodbye to her. But she was there with him. And, you know, we all said our goodbyes, had a hug and a kiss, as you do. And to then see something happen so awful, so appalling, happen in literally, and I mean this literally, the same spot we were standing in just over a month ago. It just made it a bit more visceral. And then there was just a few minutes after I got in touch with her earlier this afternoon. What happened was I saw news of this and I texted her, sent her a WhatsApp message saying what was going on. Had she heard about it? Was she okay? Obviously, that was the first thing I was thinking of. She then obviously tried to get in touch with her boyfriend, couldn't get in touch with him. So she was obviously freaked out. I was freaked out at this end. The news then came through that he had been in touch with her and he was okay. So that was that. But for a while there, it was really, really quite freaky. And my stomach and my heart and my head is not right for it. And I know that many of you listening to this, who live in London, who have gone through similar things this year and in the past, people who live in various parts of the world that have also gone through things like this, in Paris, for example, in America, where attacks like this have happened. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about here, or how I'm feeling in some weird way. I felt very far away from her. I'm very upset for her. On top of just the sheer horror and the abhorrence of watching something like this happen again, regardless of where it is, that it's somewhere I know so well, where I lived for so many years, that I love so much, makes it I don't know what it makes you. It makes me feel so upset for the people who've lost their lives, for their families and friends, for the people of that city. At this time of the year, that would have been packed, the Ramblas. Local people, people on their holidays, men, women, kids, just not expecting something like this, for their lives to be changed so suddenly and irrevocably. I just can't get my head around why people want to hurt each other like this. I find the world a fucking strange and scary and upsetting place right now. In so many ways, these fake ideologies that these people hide behind to justify something that is completely unjustifiable, to carry out an attack on innocent people who are minding their own business, who haven't done anyone any harm, in a beautiful city. Not that it matters, does it? It doesn't matter whether it's a beautiful city or a shithole. It doesn't matter. The things that people think are acceptable these days that are not acceptable, they shouldn't be acceptable to anybody, to any decent person. Leaving politics or whatever exactly to one side, whether you're liberal or conservative, whether you're right wing or left wing, there are things that are just simply unacceptable. This is one of those things. Carrying flags with swastikas on them, that's another one of those things. Imagine having to say in 2017 that Nazis are not acceptable. There is no face of Nazism or white supremacy that's acceptable or should be tolerated or justified or condoned in any way. It's 2017. But maybe what it tells us is that some people, it doesn't matter for them whether it's 2017 or 1917 or 1817. Whatever the fuck goes on in their heads in the empty spaces where there should be some fucking brains. Or the other empty space where there should be a heart. I guess we're just going to have to deal with those people. Deal with the damage that they inflict on society and inflict on all of us. And all we can do is do our best to be good and to be decent and to be kind, to care for one another, to look after each other, to love one another. Because we only get one fucking go at this. You get one go at this. And some cunt could come along in a van and fucking end it in an instant without you even knowing a thing about it. Sorry about this, but it's on my mind and in my head. And it feels a bit close to home. And I know many of you will be aware of what it is that I'm thinking or how I'm feeling about this. So, I'm sorry for waffling on. But before this happened, I had a good conversation with Philippe Auclair before any of this stuff from Barcelona came through. So that's what I'm going to do for this podcast from here on in. I'm not going to say another word. I'm not going to say anything at the end. I'm not going to do a bit after the music. I'm just going to play out this conversation with Philippe, in which we talk about the start to our season. We talk about, it sounds so fucking trivial, doesn't it? Sounds so fucking meaningless almost. But look, I know, look, life goes on. The world keeps turning and tomorrow's another day and all that stuff. But look, we talk about lots of stuff. We talk about defending and transfers and Alexis and central midfielders and all that kind of crack. So it's a good chat, as it always is with Philippe. But this precursor, this intro, I'm sorry, hasn't been my most entertaining or uplifting one of all time. If you've listened to it, thank you. I might put something on the website or in the podcast description to tell people that this is what's here. If they don't want to listen to that, I wouldn't blame them. the world's fucking tough enough already, but I just kind of feel or felt like I had to talk about it, so I have, and that's it. So let's do it. This is the Arsecast, episode number 434, my conversation with Philippe Auclair. Thank you for listening. If you've done this, folks, take it easy and look after yourselves. All right, joining me now on the Arsecast, delighted to welcome back, as ever, Philippe Auclair. Happy new season to you, Philippe.
Season's greetings to you, Andrew, and to everyone.
Season's greetings, indeed. We got off to an interesting start, I guess you'd say, against Leicester. We've sort of done the game, the specifics of the game, on Monday with James in the Arsecast Extra. But just in terms of how you get your season going, too often for Arsenal it's been a slow start. Yeah. This was anything but, and I think the 3 points were clearly very important.
Yes. I mean, what was quite remarkable was how it mirrored what had happened against Liverpool the season before, but with it mirrored it, as it the image was inverted at the end, so that it was a 4-3 score line, but in favour of Arsenal. I mean, I have to say, when it was 3-2 up, I mean, like everybody who was at the ground, I thought, here we go again. And especially given how optimistic Wenger and some of his players had seemed to be in the pre-season, it would have been an absolutely awful result, but it was not. As you say, it was a very strange game. I was there. I didn't know whether to laugh or to cry. I laughed in the end, I suppose. It was amazingly entertaining, all these sort of things. It was also, I think, quite rich in, I wouldn't say things we learned. I don't want to talk like a bad Guardian column here. But things, perhaps some light thrown on some situations. I'm thinking of the Giroud one in particular.
Yeah.
As well as on Lacazette and how he could fit in, and also some of the obviously some of the things which are still missing in the squad.
Sure.
So it was a very interesting game, as well as in the end an excellent result, as it turned out, especially since a couple of the other, titled contenders, I've said it, had a pretty tough weekend.
So, that's true.
All in all, very satisfactory, I have to say. Even though the way it got there to be satisfactory was not that satisfactory.
Sure. Well, we might touch on the defending, because I'm interested in your thoughts on something in a minute. But I think when we look at that Leicester game, how interesting is it that Arsenal have gone out and bought a striker for £50 million, Alexandre Lacazette, who opens his scoring in the second minute? You know, gone immediately is all that pressure of getting your first goal, which we know has been an issue for really good players in the past. You think of Bergkamp and Henry, who took so long to get off the mark. But bookending that result was one from Olivier Giroud, a player who many thought would be on the way out because of the arrival of Lacazette. I think that's quite an interesting dynamic there, that there is a new Arsenal. There is a new thought about how to attack and what way our attacking play is going to go. But also, there is a need to retain some of the qualities that we already have with Olivier Giroud. And I was glad to hear that he was going to stay for the season, because I think over the course of this campaign, he is a player that we are going to need, even if role is going to be slightly more limited than it has been.
It's difficult to tell, Andrew. I mean, I've been talking to quite a lot of friends about this, and I've talked to Giroud himself and to Wenger about his situation. He made a very brave choice. I mean, he refused. He could have gone from the club. He had an open door, as Wenger confirmed. He could have gone to a club where he would have been paid more money, where he would have been a starter. That's Everton. Everybody knows about that. There were offers from other leagues as well. And he decided, no, I'm going to stay put. And it was not a Winston Bogart kind of I'm staying put. It was very much the staying put of somebody who wants to fight for his place in a World Cup year, a World Cup season. That's quite admirable. One of the reasons why his decision is unlike perhaps decisions taken by other players in the past is that he thinks he's going to have the opportunities, and I think he's going to get them. It's not just the fact that you can already, if he's fit, put him down for every single Europa League game there's going to be this season, and there might be a few. And in this so-called smaller competitions, the fact that he's bound, even if he's on the bench, he's going to play 20 to 30 minutes of every single game, I would imagine. But also that there are some teams against which I think he will be first choice. Mm-hmm. Especially away from home, in teams that, for example, pose an aerial threat, because he contributes an awful lot in terms of defending, particularly on dead ball situations. I know that's a little bit exotic when I'm saying now, but it's something which I know is on his mind. Is also they're very conscious of that at the club, that he can bring something there too, which Lacazette obviously cannot bring. Also, the fact that Lacazette scored after something like 98 seconds doesn't necessarily mean he's completely adapted to the game. When I talked to him after the game, he said it had been pretty tough as far as he was concerned, in particular the kind of treatment that he had from, Wes Morgan and Maguire. Mm-hmm. So it might take him a while in another context to show exactly what he can do. And also, I was quite pleased with the way that they worked together, Lacazette and Giroud, towards the end of the game when Lacazette moved to the left.
Yeah.
And where he looked really at ease, and he didn't look like a central striker who had been, put in a very awkward situation or in a position he's not used to.
Yeah.
His runs were clever, but also at a part of, I wouldn't call them instinctive, but they felt natural. They didn't feel forced. And so he can play in that position, which, given the fact that we're not too clear yet as to what's going to happen to the squad after 31st of August, by which I mean who's still going to be there, you could imagine, for example, in this kind of 3-4-3 formation, why couldn't he be one of the two behind Giroud, for example? So I genuinely do think that there's going to be room for both, and that it will give Arsenal some attacking potentialities or possibilities, which maybe they haven't always had in the past.
Sure. It was interesting as well, wasn't it? Because they, people talked about Giroud and Lacazette being A, incompatible, or B, as if, there was a bit of a problem between them, people reading things into, non-celebrations in preseason games, which was absolutely ludicrous. But we saw that the two combined in the build-up to that fourth goal, Lacazette could have scored from a Giroud setup, a Schmeichel save, and then from the resulting corner, Giroud got the winner. So, they're encouraging signs from an attack point of view there. I'm going to come on to who might be there and who might not be there in a minute, but just in terms of the defense, that Arsenal have this tremendous record since moving to three at the back, since the three center half options. But I was interested by a statistic put up before the Leicester game by Opta Joe, which is Arsenal's expected goals conceded with a back three was 1.66 per game compared to 1.18 per game with a back four. I think most people would say we're doing very well with that three at the back formation. How much do you think Arsene Wenger will be reading into a statistic like that? Because I'm quite sure that he's paying attention to it, or is aware of it at the very least. And when we look at this season's centre-half options, there are some questions still to be asked about what the makeup of that back three is going to be, particularly if Gabriel leaves, if Callum Chambers leaves. We do have the new boy, but there are some questions still over this back three system.
Yes. I mean, I don't think we can use the Leicester game as any kind of example worthy of this name, because when you have Kolasinac and Monreal and Holding in, as a back three, that doesn't make any sense, basically.
Yeah.
So we'll be able to judge that with when Laurent Koscielny is back. But I have to say, I didn't know that statistic, and I'm really interested by it, because Arsene has got quite now a large backroom staff of analysts, as you know, for the last two or three years now he's had that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, this is now bread and butter of analysis, the expected goals. And the difference is colossal. I mean, that's plus 50%. That's a little bit worrying, I must say. And I would like to go back to it and to have a more in-depth analysis of this. You couldn't tell me exactly where these expected goals against were coming from, because is it the fact that expected goals on dead ball situations, expected goals on a ball crossed from the lines, expected goals in what kind? You know, I'm thinking that's why they will actually go in great detail. I can't imagine it's on dead ball situation. Anyway, I'm talking nonsense here. I'm wondering if the going to three at the back, the main thing was to free some space on for players like Oxlade-Chamberlain, mm-hmm. Who was very good in that. So I think it was more of an attacking move than a defensive move, in some ways.
Yeah.
A way of owning space when we're now working in a league where the tactical setups have changed quite dramatically in the space of what, a few months. Since I believe 17 of the 20 teams last season played with a back three or back five, to which you should add West Brom, which played with a back six or back seven most of the time, it seems. But there has been a big change, and you've got to go with that. And I think that was one of the reasons, that and the injuries as well, which happened to various people in the defensive sector. You went back to a back four of sorts against Leicester when things were really bad. But there again, I don't think you can read too much into that, because everybody's noticed the fact that we had four full-backs, including two which were on the wrong side. So I don't think you can read too much into that. I was really intrigued. Have you heard about these things about Virgil van Dijk as well? I'm a little bit surprised by that. You can edit that out if you haven't followed that. But there are some rumours that... Arsenal could be a late incomer for Van Dijk after Gabriel and Chambers leaving, which would make an awful lot of sense.
Well, it would make sense, wouldn't it? Because when you look at the roster of centre-halves, Mertesacker's in his final year, Koscielny, still a very good player, but dealing with that ongoing Achilles issue, and that's something they're going to have to manage throughout the season. Mustafi is there, Rob Holding is there, and I think as a young centre-half, he still has some learning to do, as Arsene Wenger spoke about at the Football Writers event that you were part of, and we'll talk about a little bit later on. So, yeah, if they do let Gabriel and Chambers go, it seems to me that we need a central defender. So if you're hearing things about Virgil van Dijk, that's certainly very interesting.
Well, from the time being, they might just be idle rumours. Mm. You know, it's very tempting to, especially when it comes to so-called swap deals, which are things which almost never happen in football. In fact, I think the Galas call one was a kind of swap deal, is about the only one I can think of which actually happened. But I guess people are getting a bit excited. And of course, the Van Dijk situation is bizarre. Nobody expects him to stay at Southampton, but nobody expects him to go to Liverpool either. So I guess there's an awful lot of hot air circulating at the moment. So feel free to drop that on the cutting floor if need be.
Absolutely not. I'm leaving that all the way in. And I'm leaving this bit in too, just so people can get a behind the scenes of how a podcast might work. but just in terms of the defensive side of our game, and also maybe we're replete with options from an attacking point of view, and where it does feel like we're a bit light, or we could be light, is central defence if those players go, but also central midfield, is that somewhere that you feel we need a body? Yeah. Because I certainly do.
Yes, I do. And you know what I was thinking of yesterday when I was watching Celtic? I was looking at, apropos of nothing, but apropos of Arsenal. Because I saw a player there who is exactly the type of player that Arsenal haven't got, who is the young Enchan, the player who came from Genoa to Celtic for 4.5 million. Mm-hmm. Just the same way that I used to think that Victor Wanyama was exactly the type of player that Arsenal needed. And I had exactly the same response when I saw him. I thought, gosh, this is a player who does a little bit of a Gilberto Silva kind of job, sort of invisible wall.
Yeah.
And who has a great sense of placement and knows how to make himself available to the back four or back three or back five to have transitions, in the transitions when you bring the ball from defense. It sounds very simple. It's a very difficult thing to do, to find these pockets of space, to have this sense of timing. It's a bit like a striker or a winger timing a run. Midfielders too have to time the way they move in midfield, perhaps not at the same kind of speed, but they've got to have the same alertness to space as a forward has. And that's the side of the game that I think can go completely unseen. Gilberto Silva was the ultimate master in that, because you were wondering, how can he do such great work when he doesn't seem to ever do anything? And, well, because that's what he's good at. And some players are good at that. And at the moment at Arsenal, even if I've got quite a lot of regard for Mohamed Elneny, whom I think is what people call an honest player, somebody who will give you exactly what you think is going to give you game after game after game, I don't think we've got that player yet. And I don't think we've had it for a very long time, in fairness. Mm. Maybe we haven't had it since the great Gilberto Silva left the club, to my eternal regret, something that I will never get over. Mm. And I think that the problem is more there. And that I feel that the opponent is given far too much freedom in front of the back three or back four, that there is not enough... It's not just snapping at the heels, but also cutting the channels, cutting the space, occupying the space where the pass can be made. And again, these type of players are very, very difficult to find. And when you see one, I think for me, they're blindingly obvious that they're very good. And I'm talking about this young chap and Cham, but I'm not saying because I want him to go to the Arsenal. It's precisely because when I saw him, I thought, this is exactly what is lacking in the team at the moment.
Do you feel like that is more or less the missing piece if we, you know, leave aside the centre of defence, which of course is hugely important, but there is the personnel there at the moment to deal with central defence. Whether that's true in a week's time remains to be seen. But it, you know, to me, it feels like that is the thing, the glue kind of that we need to be able to link our the three areas of the field together as well as we should be able to do it.
Yes, I mean, I genuinely do feel that. Of course, at the moment, we're all speaking in the conditional because we still do not know whether Alexis is going to stay for the last year of his contract. I think everybody feels that the Ox and Ozil will probably do. But at Alexis, there is still a lot of uncertainty around it.
Do you think that, actually? Can I be interject there? Because to me, it feels more like Oxlade-Chamberlain is the one over whom there are more doubts, because throughout the summer, Arsene Wenger has been absolutely categorical. And I know he said this stuff before about Van Persie and Nasri and Fabregas, and I realize that. I went through it. We all lived it. We were there. But the financial situation was very different, and I can't remember him ever being quite as strident as often when it comes to a player staying. And he said Alexis Sanchez will be an Arsenal player when the window closes. He will accept it, which sort of hints to an idea, or the idea that maybe Alexis wants to go. With Oxlade-Chamberlain, he is a bit more open. He says, I want him to stay, but he's not been quite as categorical there. Do you feel like there's still the possibility of Alexis going, or Arsenal allowing Alexis Sanchez to leave? Because to me, it's hard to see where he goes. Manchester City appear to be the only destination at this point, unless PSG find another 100 million down the back of the sofa, which is not, of course, beyond the realms of possibility. But the idea of Arsenal selling him to Man City, again, I just don't see it happening. So it seems more likely to me Alexis will stay.
I agree with you, and that's what I've been saying for the past 6 months. And but two things. First of all, when Arsene talks about players and contract situations, the message is not aimed at us. It's aimed at the players and their agents and other clubs.
Uh-huh.
So they're playing hardball with Alexis because they simply want the agent and Alexis to understand, you know, just take it easy, guys. We want to play hardball. There is not quite the same intensity around Alexis. Alexis, not Alexis, but Alex is Oxlade-Chamberlain, that is, situation. And so this might explain this in part. The second thing is, I heard Arsene say something very interesting during this FWA do that we will just say a few words about. It was that he said you should prepare yourself to have far more players staying until the very end of their contract. And you should also be prepared to clubs keeping players until the very end of their contract. When he said that, I thought, you're talking about Alexis, aren't you? Because you said, well, on the agent side, what has changed is that they're taking on board the inflation, which is hitting the market every 12 months, basically. And so when you, in a way, when you delay the decision, you stand to make more money in 12 months' time, if it is indeed the last year of your contract. There's a big signing on fee coming. There will have been yet another upsurge in the market. Nobody's seeing an end to what we, you know, is predicting an end to what we are seeing at the moment. So it makes an awful lot of sense. If you're in the last year of your contract, go to the end of it. You'll make more money by staying than by leaving now. And the second thing, it means the clubs are also the same. They take a financial hit by not selling, but they are also in a situation where they don't have to find a replacement at an extra price. So in a way, I can understand that. And when he said that, I genuinely thought he's talking about the situation of three of his players, Alexis, but he's also talking about Oxlade-Chamberlain, and he's also talking about Mesut Ozil.
Yeah.
And I found it fascinating. And I wouldn't be surprised if Arsenal, in this particular occurrence, especially since, as you said, the financial situation is completely different now than what it was when Van Persie left, if they did what Bayern did with Mikhail Ballack and say, okay, you know, you're staying last year. No, you're not going. And you'd better be good, because people might not come for you if you are completely pants during the season. They will show that you're just a mercenary or something like that.
Yeah. So,
It's a gamble worth taking.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It is, but it's interesting. Whatever Bayern did with Mikhail Ballack, that's one player. Arsenal have three players, two of their star players, Oxlade-Chamberlain, who I think is, you know, a very useful squad player, but seems to be refusing any new offers because of his desire to play as a central midfielder or to get more playing time. I don't think it's necessarily so much about the money with Oxlade-Chamberlain, although I do think it's got to be a factor, of course, when you take into account who his agent is and what his agent has done in the past. But, you know, the financial thing is interesting. Arsene Wenger saying that the club might have to take a financial sacrifice or make a financial sacrifice because they could get, let's say, £50 million for Alexis Sanchez this summer.
Yeah.
However, if they give Alexis Sanchez what he wants, which is somewhere, we believe, between £300,000 and £400,000 a week, and let's round it down to just over £300,000 a week, if they don't take £50 million from now and then renew his contract next summer, they've got to pay him £65 million over the course of 4 years. So that's certainly a factor. And actually, something he said at the event that you were at, the Football Writers Association event, he said, you speak to an agent and he says, today my player is earning £3 million. But with all the money, the TV rights, and when we see what others are earning, we want £8 million.
Yep.
And he says, and we can't raise someone's salary by £5 million like that. Now, £3 million sounds a lot of money, but it's low, generally speaking, on the footballer's salary list. That's about £60,000 a week. But when you're talking about players like Ozil and Sanchez, who are earning £130,000-£140,000 a week, they want to double that at least. You're talking about raising their salary by a bit more than £5 million every year. And I think that was quite pointed as well, wasn't it? He was talking about these players wanting massive rises in money, which you can understand because they're at the peak of their careers. They're at the top of the market themselves. If they went to another club, they could expect a big salary. But it perhaps feeds into the way Arsene Wenger is thinking. It's not necessarily so much about keeping those players because they're great players, although that's a big factor. It's because of the financial side of it as well.
Yes, I entirely agree with you. I think the two are intertwined and are completely indissociable at the moment. I'm 100% with you on this one, and that we will have to see Arsenal's transfer dealings in that light for the foreseeable future. And by the way, I think it's a perfectly rational way to approach a transfer market. And it also makes me very grateful that Kolasinac was acquired for precisely zilch, which is quite exceptional. I mean, even if his salary must be hefty, I would imagine, as he is.
Sure.
But again, you know, we're, 17th of August. I think we should probably have a similar chat in 14 days or 15 days, and when the situation will be a little bit clearer. At the moment, we're really speaking with what ifs and not buts, right? If you see what I mean.
Sure.
It's all very conditional, but I can imagine a situation in which all three players stay for the season, the forthcoming season.
Wow.
Should be jolly good news, by the way.
Well, yeah, I think so. But it means there's a lot to do in this final 12 months because, it doesn't necessarily mean that all three are going to leave either if they don't sign, straight away. There is the possibility of convincing them during the course of the season to keep them if you want to invest that much money in them. And maybe of the three, if Arsene Wenger believes Oxlade-Chamberlain is going to be the player that everyone in England is talking about in 2 or 3 years, maybe he's worth the investment from that point of view rather than someone like Sanchez who'll be 29 and you get nothing for towards the end of his contract, if we assume that players stay longer and longer towards the end of their contract. But also, the market itself is a strange one, isn't it? Because Arsenal have a lot of players that they have deemed surplus to requirements this summer. Lucas Perez, Kieran Gibbs, Carl Jenkinson, Matthew Debushi, maybe Jack Wilshere, despite what Arsene Wenger said. A couple of others who could be perhaps on the out if we can find people to buy them. But we're not necessarily able to do that. What our valuations of those players are and what people are prepared to pay appears to be quite different. And also, there are two markets now, right? There's the European market, and then there's the English market. Yep. And from Europe to England is expensive because everyone knows that the English clubs have money. From England to England is also expensive because all the clubs know that they have money. But Europe or from England to Europe tends to be lower because the clubs can't afford the same thing. We look at Gabriel perhaps going to Valencia for £10 million, which is in the current market, it seems very low. And you look at Europe to Europe, Blaise Matuidi has gone from PSG to Juventus for about €18 million, €20 million. Even Wojciech Szczesny going from Arsenal to Juventus for around €13 million. Low prices. And the English market it's hyperinflating itself. It's becoming more and more difficult for players or for clubs to move on players that they don't want.
Well, you've got to take into consideration as well the fact that in the past year there's been this thing which happened in Britain, which means that sterling has dropped 20 cents.
Yes.
Which is a lot against the euro, which explains why, the fee for a Gabriel can look really quite small. Is that such a new situation? Is the when you take into consideration the Brexit effect, which is also an effect on wages, by the way, which is perhaps even more damaging because we're talking not just about a one-off payment, we're talking about wages over a 5-year contract. That starts to explain quite a few bizarre things which have been happening. You could say, for example, had Mohamed Salah been sold to another Italian club or to a French club rather than to Liverpool, would he have been sold for so much money? I don't think so. Genuinely, I don't think so. And you can carry on like that, but unfortunately, there's nothing much you can do about it. It's just the reality in which Arsenal and all the other Premier League clubs have got to fight. Again, I was taking the example of Ncham, who came from Genoa to Celtic. Now, he costs 4.5 million, but he's already a French international at every age category that you can think of. Mm. So he's already played two seasons in Serie A, okay, at 21. If he had been sold to Arsenal, would he have been sold for 4.5? Of course not. Over 10, easily. Mm. Over 10, easily. So I can't see a way around it. I can't see a way to change anything in that. You know, you've got 20 clubs which basically have got too much money. I've got too much money to spend.
Yeah, it is. It is.
It's crazy.
It is crazy because it completely, as much as we talk about something like the Neymar deal skewing the market, and it does to an extent because in some way a benchmark, the Premier League market is just totally skewed because you just can't really figure out what way clubs are going to operate. Like you look at what Manchester City did. They were going to sign Dani Alves before he decided to go to PSG. Now, it was going to be a free transfer, and I've got free in inverted commas, obviously, because City were going to pay him a good signing on fee and everything else. But because that didn't work, their next option is to spend £50 million mm-hmm. on Kyle Walker. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like jumping from one extreme to the other.
Yep. Their situation was a little bit different in economic terms. Even if I think exactly the same thing as you do, and I think most people do about the transfer fee, they got rid of 10 players, and players who were on very big wages, most of them last season. They have quite a lot of money to spend. They have got actually a huge amount of money to spend. Mm. When you get rid of 10 players who are on an average, I don't know, some of them, like Zabaleta, I would imagine, was on a big salary. Clichy wasn't a big salary. Sanya wasn't a big salary. So they've actually got a lot of money in the bank, plus, of course, the might of Abu Dhabi behind them, which is something which irks Arsene Wenger a great deal. But yes, they have been throwing money at their defense for quite a while. How much is it that they want to pay for Johnny Evans, for example? They probably will have to pay in excess of £20 million for him, for a player whom I doubt will be in the starting lineup.
Yeah.
I very much doubt it. Similarly, the fullbacks they've bought, they will have to be one who will be sacrificed. Amongst Danilo, Mendy, and Walker, and all of them cost an awful lot of money.
Yeah,
and you can carry on like that. But this is the financial reality in which Arsenal has to live today. Mm. And the fact that what we are seeing is that within the Premier League, we are seeing what is happening in a wider context, which is that of Europe, where you have a super elite of five or six clubs. We now have the same thing in the Premier League. We have a super elite of six clubs plus Everton. Mm. When I say five clubs plus Tottenham and Everton. Tottenham are in an interesting situation.
Know your audience, Philippe. That's what that is.
Exactly.
can I ask you just finally about Arsene Wenger? Watching the video of the Football Writers Association event, he seemed in good form. He was funny, charming, as he is quite often. But he's come through, I think, probably a very difficult and challenging time in the 6 months leading up to the FA Cup final and subsequently his new deal. Having spoken to him, how does he seem to you? I mean, is he as enthused, as encouraged as ever? Is he up for it?
Up for it, and I think he's at peace with himself again. That's how I would describe it. Because, well, of course, there was the Q&A lasted for quite a long time, but we spent about, you know, 45 minutes, an hour in the green room before then, just chatting and about football. And he was telling anecdotes, which unfortunately I can't possibly repeat, which were absolutely hilarious. but he was in great form. He was really relaxed and I think very confident in the group of players he's got. And especially, I think he's come to terms with what his attitude had been last season. He was actually very apologetic, I felt, about the fact that his indecision and the contradiction between the message he was passing to the media, yes, I've taken my decision, and I will tell you soon, and the fact that there has been no decision taken is something which had a huge impact on the group.
Does he feels that was a mistake, doesn't he?
Yeah, he felt he made a big mistake, and he feels really responsible for that. And I think he's now forgiven himself for it. And he's always been, as in, you know, he's an incredible optimist, incredibly passionate about his own job. But I found him more at peace this time round than when I talked to him before the beginning of last season, where I thought, there's something not quite right here.
Yeah.
Now I don't feel that. I don't feel that. I think he wants to have some fun. I mean, he's got these 2 years, probably his last contract, you would think.
Yeah, we've said that before.
You would think. I don't know anymore.
I wouldn't put money on it. But
you know, it's and in a funny way, he's also forgiven himself the fact of not being in the Champions League, I think. And I think, like everybody else, at the back of his mind is the fact, oh, let's have a look at what happened recently, Chelsea, Leicester, Liverpool, almost not being in the Champions League is such a huge advantage.
Did he say anything to you about the Europa League and what his approach might be towards that and how he views that particular competition?
I think he will take it as whatever it's called, the Carabao League. As in, you would expect Per Mertesacker and a few of the others to have a lot of playing time in that. I think it will be, he will take it half seriously. Mm-hmm. He will take it, you know, the usual way, usual discourse, oh, we want to win every game, blah, blah. But he will, of course, protect his players. It's all for the league this season. Absolutely, all, everything is for the Premier League. And because it's an unusual situation to be in, for him, it's the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, if you accept the UEFA Cup, you know, when in the very first season in Borussia Mönchengladbach, is that right? It was the first game of which he was present.
Yeah. And then there was the UEFA Cup after wasn't it one of the years when you drop out of the Champions League when there were two group stages when we got to the UEFA Cup final against Galatasaray, of course?
That was later on.
Yeah.
That was later on. But in any case, it's an unusual situation for him and for the club to be in. He will be able to concentrate all his energy on the Premier League. And also, I mean, this sounds... it's pretty bad to say that, but the team won't have to deal with the heartbreak of going out of Europe in February, which I think had become a problem. And I don't think that the group genuinely believed that it would go through. And every time it was a dampener on the season. And it certainly played a role as well in the fact that the autumn months, as we know, November in particular, have been difficult in the past. When you play every, three games a week and the Premier League doesn't really protect you, it becomes a real problem. And being in the Europa League is completely different. It depends how you approach it. And you can approach it like, for example, Manchester United did last year, which they paid for in the league, by the way, because they took it very seriously from the beginning. I mean, Paul Pogba played 15 games in the Europa League last year. It's crazy, isn't it?
Mm.
I wouldn't expect, if he stays, Alexis, to play 15 games in the Europa League should Arsenal go to the very end of it. So, I would expect the teams he will select for that to be B-plus teams, not A teams.
Sure.
Not more than that.
Okay, well, look, it promises to be interesting, even by virtue of being just different from what we've seen before. It could well be interesting, and hopefully the manager's enthusiasm for the Premier League will pay dividends towards the end. Philippe, we better leave it there, and we will most definitely catch up with you.
Go on. Andrew. Just one word.
Yeah.
If you don't mind, I was really struck by the atmosphere at the Emirates on the Friday of the game against Leicester. And I think an awful lot of my friends who were there in the stands were too. It had been a long time since I'd felt the Emirates crowd to be behind its team that much and that passionately. And I'm not just talking about the last few minutes, which were it was pandemonium. It was fantastic. The noise was fabulous, and the Giroud song, the way it was sung, that was really, really special. But you really felt throughout the game that there was genuine will from the fans to be behind the team. And I'm not saying that as a propagandist for the current regime or anything like that, far from it. It's just something I felt, and more interestingly, something that many of my friends who are season ticket holders felt as well. It could have gone wrong if Welbeck hadn't equalized just before halftime. That probably would have been different. But there was really something to build upon here. And I think that Arsene and the players could feel it too. But and that is perhaps for me the reason to be the most optimistic, because if I could, honestly, Andrew, my wish for the season is I wish the team and its fans to reconnect in the way it used to be, because what was appalling last season was the way in which there was now a distance had been established between the two. And as a football fan, there's nothing as horrible as that.
I totally agree with you there. It would be absolutely great. And, it's a symbiotic relationship in many ways. But, I think if it is collective, if there's a togetherness, then it's certainly a much more positive experience for everybody involved. So, that's good to hear. And hopefully that will last right throughout the season until May. Philippe, as ever, thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew.
Calling us.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.